Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For centuries, stories about Native people have been told from a colonial perspective. According to Indigenous Performance Productions, they're committed to creating opportunities for Indigenous artists to tell their own stories to audiences and learners across Turtle Island, helping to evolve the narratives about Indigenous people from stories told about them with stories told by them. Together, they reclaim their stories through programs that support and nurture Native communities in concert with the global community. Our guest today is the founder of Indigenous Performance Productions, Andre Bouchard. He was born and raised on the Flathead Reservation in western Montana, and he aspires to serve as intercultural activist, working to build bridges and reverse the invisibility that serves to marginalize Native people in the U.S. He holds a master's degree in arts management from Hines College at Carnegie Mellon University, a BFA in dance, and a BA in anthropology from University of Montana. Should mention here that a production from Indigenous Performance Productions coming to Ellen Eccles Theater in April. It's called The Aunties. We'll talk about that as we go along. Further in the program. So we do welcome in Andre Bouchard. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So I believe you're in town to kind of make plans for next spring kind of thing?
Yes, yes. With the project, The Aunties, every site that we do, that we feature storytellers from, it's a three-year arc. And so I'm here in town talking to people, trying to understand the local Indigenous community, talking to a lot of people, and giving it time to manifest the right way, you know, as it were. And with all humility, I'm not from this area, and so taking the time to understand it serves the project well in how it manifests later on in the spring.
So we encourage people to get ready to come to The Aunties. That's April 5th is when that's going to be happening in Logan. So you're in your bio. I'm reading. I skipped through this in the opening because I wasn't sure I was able to pronounce your the tribes that you're have
yes,
interest in.
Yes.
Maybe you could do that.
So yes, I grew up in the Flathead tribe, which is also known as the Salish Kootenai tribe. It's a tribal confederacy, like many tribes in the West who were, many tribes were gathered together and put on the same reservation. But yes, I was brought up in community and culture, raised in early Montana. Which was the town mentioned in Sherman Alexie's book, Toughest Indian in the World.
Mm. Yeah.
Our probably only claim to fame. It was as with many kids who grew up on the reservation, it was a mixed experience because, reservations frequently experience high poverty and the things that go along with that. But on the flip side, I was given so many stories and so many cultural experiences and nurtured by so many sort of elders in the community. And that, in large part, made me who I am and led to, ultimately, a career in the performing arts.
Mm. So you're a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology, but then you also got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Dance.
Yes.
So there's a journey there, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Like a lot of kids who, and I'm not a kid anymore, let's be clear, who sort of find themselves through the performing arts, there's a pathway. And mine obviously started on the reservation and seeing powwows and those dances and doing the round dances and, watching the traditional dancers and learning beading and doing all the cultural activities. I found my voice, like a lot of people in the performing arts, by being on stage and finding storytelling that way. But I am a lifelong aficionado of storytelling, and that's sort of really how my how my career has developed is I, you know, I got into dance and theater in college. And afterwards, I tried to make it as a director and a choreographer and that sort of thing. But I realized that I was never quite as brilliant as I wanted to be. And I started producing mostly on the fringe theater level. And that journey sort of snowballed, and I ended up with a 50-seat theater and then taking over a 200-seat theater at a community college. And it was a passion of mine. It became a passion of mine helping other artists manifest storytelling from stage. And that's really in any genre that you can think of, slam poetry, stand-up comedy, theater, dance, multidisciplinary work and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, someone has to be there to make sure that the curtain goes up. And I found tremendous reward in doing that.
So you got into producing, facilitating exactly. Other artists. You said, I'm reading from your the website, indigenousperformance.org is a good place to go. So some of the barriers are, I'll just read this. It's not uncommon to hear things from, I guess, from producers or event, you know, coordinators. Things like you're not Native enough.
Right.
Or some presenters will not book Indigenous artists because they're too cultural,
yeah.
Quote unquote. And so not enough, too much. Right. And you say it really comes down to you don't check a box, I guess. You know, the presenters have, they got to sell this, right?
Right.
But how do you overcome those barriers?
Yes. So everything has sort of a cultural lens, whether or not you think of it as such. And, you know, my parents, my mother was, had African and white ancestry, and my father had Native and white ancestry. And we bring our cultural lens with us wherever we go. And if you're German American, that's a cultural lens. If you're a knitter, that's a cultural lens. Perhaps a small C culture. If you belong to a church, that's probably a big C cultural lens and that sort of thing. And so a lot of the work that I do is trying to bring the people in the presenting world, the performing arts presenting world, who manifest theater, dance, music on our stages across the country, into an understanding that they are already producing and presenting culturally specific work. It's more Euro-American culturally specific work usually, but that it's just a matter of connecting the community that holds the culture with the culture that you're bringing to your stage and that sort of thing. And so as you pointed out, the barriers are sort of perceptual barriers, and it's a sort of a journey of understanding that I work to bring people along on with regards to that. If you met, say, a Japanese American musician, you wouldn't expect them to be necessarily playing traditional Japanese instruments and that sort of thing, or working in a traditional Japanese genre. But with Native Americans, it's the notion that we should be doing traditional arts all the time is far more pervasive. And when you get down to it, you look at the manifestation of our culture through our art, and there's a breathtaking amount of emerging art and expression from Native communities right now. It's really a renaissance period, and I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, I have my ear to the ground and my eyes to the horizon, as it were, and I am surprised every week by new artists that have been working very hard in communities on a local or regional basis that I'd never been aware of. For instance, like an artist that I've been working with for the better part of 10 years, Delbert Anderson, he's Diné. Navajo, and he's a jazz musician and a trumpeter of, you know, national prominence. Now he was featured in the New York Times. And the way he manifests his culture through his music is by taking Navajo spinning songs and making those, weaving those into the melodies of his jazz. And when you look for these things, you find, you know, newness, perhaps, from what you might be used to. And as sort of a community member who's venturing into an intercultural space. And there's a reason for celebration in discovering this newness.
I want to read this. This takes us back a little bit. We can move forward again. I just thought this was such a funny line. Ellen Maldonado, in the blog post on your site, indigenousperformance.org, I just want to read this. She says, honestly, the moment an indigenous person mentions storytelling, it's assumed that the wind needs to be blowing through our long, unkempt hair, and someone needs to be banging a drum to bring out the rain dance.
Yes.
So you're juxtaposing that with this Dene artist who's a jazz musician, right?
There's a
whole wide world out there.
Right. And I mean, traditionally, we've always had something that looks like theater. Because theater in sort of a European sort of context emerged from, you know, traveling shows that showed up and put down roots in like the town square and that sort of thing. And so like, you know, just taking storytelling in a public place. Native communities have always had storytelling in a public place. They might be framed around different things, but most of the stories that I heard from my elders growing up in community were told around the kitchen table. And they were funny stories about this uncle or that cousin who was doing, you know, something funny or something that, you know, they might shake their heads at or that sort of thing. And, or, you know, the horse that went on like a journey down the road to find other horses and that sort of thing got out of their pen. And they were contemporary stories. And our traditional stories in the Flathead tribe, the Salish Kootenai tribe, were told during a storytelling season in our tribe. It's the, you know, the first snowfall and the first thunder of spring. And outside of that, you're not supposed to tell traditional stories, but you don't stop storytelling, right? And so, I mean, contemporary storytelling is alive and well in Native communities. You know, the story of how, you know, your niece was born, and this is something that we celebrate and then something that we encourage within our communities and that sort of thing is this the mental muscle of being able to like sit down with a bunch of people and tell stories frequently. And Ellen was our intern last year. And she's a lovely, lovely human being. And she hits on something really important there that, you know, Hollywood, for instance, has painted a picture through, you know, like the Westerns and that sort of thing as, you know, the stoic warrior or, you know, that sort of thing. And this notion has taken root in so many people's psyche. That when offered sort of an accounting of who we are that perhaps differs from that substantially, there it evokes emotional responses around, well, no, that's not right. You guys are, you know, noble and spiritual and that sort of thing. Where, you know, I personally would love to believe myself noble, but I don't know if my wife would agree to that. And certainly spiritual, like I pray, but probably not in the way you're thinking about. And yeah. And so we're fighting against like these notions of like how Hollywood has portrayed us, how the literary world has portrayed us. And there is a world that we are trying to show through our work on stage that is beautiful and vast. There are 574 federally recognized tribes and over 100 more that are recognized on a statewide basis. And between our traditional and contemporary art, there is a huge body of creative expression that one can explore and one can find inspiration and insight and connection and life lessons even.
Let's take a brief break. We'll come back with much more with Andre Bouchard. He is founder of Indigenous Performance Productions. Indigenous Performance Productions will be bringing a show called The Aunties in April. It's coming to the Ellen Ackles Theater in Logan on April 5th. It's part of a Utah Humanities Grant in partnership with Utah Presents Kingsbury Hall. It's a multimedia storytelling experience that honors Indigenous matriarchs. We'll talk more about that after the break. We'll have much more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today is the founder of Indigenous Performance Productions, Andre Bouchard. He was born and raised on the Flathead Reservation in western Montana. Got degrees in anthropology and dance, also arts management. Started out in storytelling, and now he facilitates. He wants to get Indigenous performers on the stage, give them opportunities. And so he does that through Indigenous Performance Productions. So, Andre Bouchard, I want to talk about this idea of invisibility. Somewhere on there's a reading a blog post on your site talking, it might have been by you, yeah. Talking about the fact that a surprising number of people believe that Indigenous people are extinct or going to become extinct. They're just not around. And that this manifests itself in, I guess, performing arts in, and you mentioned movies, for example.
Yeah.
The mainstream culture telling stories about Native peoples instead of engaging with you, right?
Right. And Native invisibility is sort of a multi-layered and complicated sort of issue. Starting with the U.S. Census or, statistical measurements of Native communities. Frequently, you'll see, four categories for our demographics in this country, like white, black, Hispanic, and other. And that sort of other is sort of key to the idea around that we're invisible. Because even though we were the first people objectively in this land, and we've been here for, also objectively over 10,000 years since time immemorial, Native communities are frequently othered or, left out of the conversation because of this idea of being statistically insignificant. One of the biggest surprises in the last U.S. Census was that the number of Native people went from roughly 4 million to around 10 million. And that was just in the way that the U.S. Census asked the question. And previously, they've been asking the question of, do you identify as Native American or American Indian only? The change in number came from them asking the question of, do you identify as Native American or American Indian as part of one of your racial backgrounds? And descendancy is an enormous part of Native identity because we have citizens and due to tribal enrollment requirements of blood quantum and that sort of thing. And that's a much more complicated issue than we actually have time to really get into tremendously here. But you have quite a few people who are disenrolled. My father was enrolled. I am not. There's actually a committee at my my tribe right now looking at changing blood quantum requirements to perhaps lineal descendancy, which is what some tribes have, such as like the Cherokee tribe. There are three Cherokee tribes, but at least one of them has lineal descendancy. And so Native invisibility includes ideas such as red face, so non-Native people playing Native roles in movies or TV and that sort of thing. It has issues such as the statistical omission of our communities and that sort of thing. But sort of more on a ground level, as a storyteller, I saw it growing up and that I didn't see anyone who looked like me, who had my lived experience really on stage or in film, substantively. I believe it was 1998 that the movie Smoke Signals was released. Mm-hmm. And Chris Eyre made that film when he was, I believe, like 24. It was out of a Sherman Alexie book, and the first line, or at least the first line of the film, was from a radio station, a res radio station, and it was "It's a good time to be indigenous," and I view that movie actually as sort of like the first time that I and a lot of other Native folk were able to start thinking bigger. Like, yeah, we can have a movie. Yeah, we can have a TV show. And there's been sort of a pathway to becoming. And more recently, you see movies coming out like Res Dogs, Rutherford Falls. You see a lot more books released by Native authors. Joy Harjo was the U.S. Poet Laureate. There have now been, in my count, 13 Native American state poet laureates. And like visibility is slowly, you know, we're slowly becoming more visible. We're slowly being able to tell our own stories more. And as a result, like it's a snowball effect. I think our young people have more aspirations when they see people actualize, they see people manifest these stories. And so invisibility, yes, and it's a huge problem. And still to this day, we hear, you know, the notion that we are extinct, our many nations, like were died out and that sort of thing. More back on the, I feel like, the East Coast than out here in the West, because there is more presence in communities for you know, tribes and Native individuals. But it's a journey of understanding, and the job I have and the job that people I work with have is to start people down on that pathway. To understand that there is a vibrant culture here, there's a living culture, and that we are reviving our language programs. We are building our communities up, and our young people are creating, and these are creations that you can enjoy, and you are invited to enjoy them. And that's another question that I actually get a lot. Now, as a white person, can I wear Native jewelry? And the answer is yes, absolutely. It's a way of supporting our emerging artists, our stories told through creative art and that sort of thing. Mm. And as long as it's made by a Native artist, right? You know, obviously, if you don't buy from a Native artist, you're not supporting a Native artist. But there's an outfit out of Seattle called Eighth Generation that does a lot of Native products and that sort of thing. And the tagline is "Inspired Natives, not Native inspired." Mm. So.
Brings up a further question, where's the line between supporting Native American artists and artisans and cultural appropriation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Native communities, I have to get permission from my elders. I have to get permission from community. And that's one of the things that I do when I do site visits. One of the reasons I'm here in Logan is to get permission, is to talk to people and make sure I'm doing the things the right way. When you're in a Native community, I mean, you are welcome to, in general, come to our powwows and that sort of thing. There's just, you know, a few rules, like don't take photos of people in regalia without their permission, ask permission, stand during grand entry, and that sort of thing. But it's these events are open to the general public. And this is, you know, speaking to the idea of being an ally and sort of not appropriating, and those are, I feel like, two sides of the same coin. Appropriation is when you represent it as something of your own, and that you know, that you falsely claim Native identity. And, you know, recognizing that not everyone's family tree is terribly clear about who their ancestors were and that sort of thing. But, you know, doing your due diligence and trying to understand, you know, if you think you're of Native descent, exactly what tribe, and you know, doing your family tree and connecting with people of that culture, because there's blood and then there's culture, and blood is something you inherit, right? It's who you are. It's what's running through your veins, and there's culture, and that's taught, and those are intertwined sort of elements of Native identity, and it's tremendously complicated, again, because, like, not everyone's family tree is tremendously clear about who is who and that sort of thing. And so personally, I generally am a little bit forgiving of this. But, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, just doing the work and understanding, like, if you're of, you know, tribal descent, connecting with that tribe and doing your best to understand, you know, the community and the culture and the values, and to give back, that sort of thing.
You mentioned being an ally, and you've written about this. I just want to read this one sentence. The only way you can begin to be effective as an ally for Indigenous people is to show up. Some people, I guess, believe, well, I can't attend that powwow. I can't engage. You're saying, yeah, you're welcome. You have to be respectful, but you're welcome.
Exactly. You know, watch the people around you and try to understand, you know, like how to be in that space. Every cultural space has rules. If you go to a funeral, there's rules around that. You know, cracking jokes at a funeral might not be welcome in most cases and that sort of thing, but it depends upon sort of the context. And so if you go, being curious is something that's welcome. And asking questions is welcome as well. But, you know, there's a lot of information online as well, and you can do a lot of the legwork, to understanding, you know, how to be in a situation that you can find online, because there are a lot of people who write about these things. And, you know, YouTube is a wonderful thing. You can see, you know, sort of how people are in space, how people are in a cultural event and that sort of thing. And, you know, reading. I mean, there are some very well-regarded Native authors that talk about our challenges and our reasons for celebration, and that gives you context as well. So, yeah, do your homework, read. There's many vocal Native people who've talked a lot with the media and that sort of thing that you can go and listen to interviews and that sort of thing. And if you want to, you know, contribute, if you want to be an ally, showing up means a lot of different things. like advocating for legislation that helps our communities with the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people, writing letters in support of tribal environmental concerns, and doing things as simple as, supporting us with your pocketbook, like going to shows such as Yanti's or, gifting, Native beadwork to your spouse or that sort of thing. It all helps because, it's no secret that many of our communities struggle with issues of poverty and that sort of thing. And so providing that economic sort of way of supporting really can help substantively because, we need to pay our rent too.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's do talk about the Yanti's. You do this around the country, right? And it's coming to Logan on April 5th at Cash Arts at the Ellen Echols Theater in downtown Logan. Tell us what this is.
So the Yanti's is my organization. I run a nonprofit, Indigenous Performance Productions, dedicated to storytelling from stage mostly. I'm actually an accidental documentary filmmaker. So the origination of this series came from me wanting to honor my aunties, the Native women who helped raise me while I was growing up on the reservation and that sort of thing. And, my aunties later on in life, those women who mentored me in storytelling and theater arts and that sort of thing. There's the notion that I could take, 70 and 80 year old people on tour was shot down pretty quickly because, one of them leveled with me that I don't particularly want to jump on planes and live out of hotels for weeks at a time. I sort of was retooling, and then the pandemic rolled in and I started writing grants, and I got all the grants that I wrote, which was surprising. And I was faced with the decision of like, well, do I just do a cell phone on Ring Light, or do I make this into something more sort of permanent? And I think the universe was telling me that it needed to be something. It needed to be a resource for our communities. And so I made it into a series. And last year in the fall, we sort of got going on this series, and we did four sites in Bellingham on Olympia, Washington, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Three storytellers per site, 12 in the season, and all the footage is in post-production now, and we hope to release 12 short profiles of these storytellers, these women, next year. And so this year, obviously, we're coming to Logan, but we're also coming to L.A., Seattle, and Yakima. And so it's a series, and every time I ask the question, well, what is this? I'm answered by funders and that sort of thing that it needs to be, robust. It needs to be a resource for our communities, and so we're gathering these stories, and it's a really. It's a really heavy place to be, because going to Native elders, going to women that and in communities whose stories haven't always been well cared for or fostered, is an enormous responsibility. That's why each of the sites sort of has a 3-year arc. And we hope to come back again after that 3 years. We show up a year beforehand or the previous year, and we do site visits and we talk to people and we try to understand whose story the community wants to elevate. And so after talking with, you know, 6, 8, 10 sort of Native community leaders, we start to get references of as to the storytellers. And so over the last 3 days, I've been talking to people, and one name came up 4 times. And so that makes absolute sense. That person, we should approach them. And that's one of the storytellers that we should try to feature. And so so it's a multi-day, multi-month process. And then we work together with that storyteller. The director of this series is an amazing woman called Kendra Milnichuk Potter, who is Lummi, Lummi Nation. And she was the subject of her own documentary, Daughter of a Lost Bird. And she's a Native adoptee. She was raised by a white family. And the documentary is about her actually making her way back to culture and community as a Native adoptee. She loves her white family. They raised her well. But she also has her Native family now. And recognizing that documentaries have a history of exploiting their subjects, it was important for me to find someone who had been through that process and understood how to avoid the pitfalls. Because the trust that we try to build in communities is essential to the success of this project. And that we write in to the agreements that we have with the storytellers that they can withdraw consent at any point in time, because we want to make sure that whatever we do with their stories is something that honors them, that honors their families, that honors their communities. And so, I mean, this is a very serious project for something that manifests so joyfully. And past storytellers that we've had, for instance, we were in Minnesota, and one of our storytellers was Justice Anne McCaig, who was the first Native American woman to be on a state Supreme Court. And she told the story of a person who she knew from her reservation, who she saw and held as an infant, and she saw, you know, grow. And as she herself became a lawyer and then a judge and then a justice, she kept up with him. And he entered into like the foster care system and then the juvenile justice system and then the adult justice system. And she shared with the audience letters back and forth between her and this person. And the story that she told was how we can love people even though we don't love the decisions they make. And that love is essential to them finding, you know, the good in themselves and becoming, you know, a full member of community again. And another of our storytellers, like Sandy Whitehawk, who has done work on a nationwide basis to reunite Native adoptees with their communities, she decided to tell a love story about how she found love in the latter part of her life. And her fellow was in the audience, just sinking lower in his seat because she was roasting him, and the audience was laughing. It was, and afterwards, she came up to me and she's like, "Andre, you run a stand-up comedy tour, Native stand-up comedy tour, don't you?" And I was like, "Yes, I do." And she's like, "I think I'm pretty funny. I think I could be that, you know, I could be a stand-up comic." And I was like, "Oh, Sandy, they make so much less than you do." And she's like, oh, never mind that. And so, yeah. So there's so many emergent sort of stories that sort of, because we don't tell our storytellers what to say. And we ask them to talk for 30 minutes, but, you know, sometimes they talk for 45. But you'll never notice the how fast the time passes, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's been a weighty and joyous process in this project. And this year we're doing these four sites, and next year we hope to be, we've been invited to do sites in the D.C. Maryland area, the Hawaiian Islands, and Walla Walla, Washington. And I hope to build this up so that we have a substantial body, ultimately, you know, that we can maybe create an app and like drop a pin and you can be delivered. You can find stories of the people of the land wherever you go, you know, in this country.
Well, wonderful. Let's take a quick break. Come back with a very short final segment. We're talking with Andre Bouchard. He is the founder of Indigenous Performance Productions, and he just talked about the Aunties. That's coming to the Ellen Echoes Theater in Logan on April 5th, so all the way, but it takes a lot of prep to create that performance, but you won't want to miss it. The Aunties coming to Ellen Echoes Theater April 5th. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking with Andre Bouchard. He's founder of Indigenous Performance Productions, and one of their productions is called The Aunties. That's coming to the Ellen Echoes Theater in Logan on April 5th. It's a while away, but put it on your calendar, April 5th. So, Andre, we just have about 3 minutes left in this final segment. I want to follow up. You said you run a stand-up comedy, Indigenous stand-up comedy. Yes. I want to get your two-minute answer on that. That's just, I can't pass that up.
Yeah, no, I read the book. We had a little real estate problem during the pandemic, and I was like, wow, that's really good idea, like getting, you know, stand-up into performing arts venues and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we run, I do a stand-up comedy tour once a year. I also have a horror storytelling show that's going to be premiering this October and hopefully touring. It's called The Land of Spoken Tales of Indigenous Horror. I'm also next year working on launching a storytelling project between focusing on Native veterans, military veterans. Called Stories from the Warrior Society. So yeah, lots coming up, and lots by my sort of my peers in the field, in, you know, the theater arts and music world, and so on. There's a lot to discover.
All right, and you can check out a bunch of that. I'd imagine at Indigenous Performance.org.
Yeah,
see your website, IndigenousPerformance.org. Well, a lot there, and do put it on your calendar. The Aunties is coming to the Ellen Echoes Theater in Logan April 5th. And Andre Bouchard, founder of Indigenous Performance Productions, is in town in preparation for that and was kind enough to come into studios with us. Andre Bouchard, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher.
It's many cultures, one sky. Skywatcher Leo T. here. As we look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space, astronaut James McDivitt didn't get too lost, though. He commanded Apollo 9, and he has slipped the surly bonds of Earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds. That's from a poem penned by pilot John McGee in 1941 called High Flight. James McDivitt and the crew of Apollo 9 tested the first complete set of command module and lunar module to go to the moon. He died Thursday in Tucson at 93. Along with David Scott, Russell Swigert, they were the follow-up to Apollo 8, which went to the moon and orbited without a lunar module. Apollo 9 tested the lunar module in Earth orbit extensively, as well as all of the Apollo systems, and were a ground or space-breaking flight, I should say, that paved the way to land on the moon with Apollo 11. McDivitt was also the commander of 1965's Gemini 4 mission, where his friend and colleague Ed White made the first U.S. spacewalk. Oh, have you seen the photos? They're historic photos of White during the spacewalk, became iconic images of White dangling against the command module with his umbilical cord against a beautiful background of the blue, blue Earth with very white, swirly clouds. And on his first flight in 1965, McDivitt reported seeing something out there, something about the shape of a beer can flying outside the Gemini spaceship. People called it a UFO, and McDivitt would later joke that he became a world-renowned UFO expert. And speaking of spaceships to the moon, Artemis 1, the latest attempt to go back to the moon. The uncrewed orbital mission has seen delays from hurricanes and other snags, and they're ironing those out. As is the case for a first-time liftoff, it's still a test flight. The latest date is November 14, and if all goes well, Artemis 1 and the STS spaceship will rocket around the moon and back to Earth to thoroughly test its system before flights with astronauts. This one's going to take a while, 25 days. Heading further out into the solar system and celebrating the 25th anniversary is Cassini. Cassini was the first mission to orbit Saturn to land on the outer solar system and sample an extraterrestrial ocean. October 15th was the 25th anniversary of the Cassini launch, a joint endeavor of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Italian Space Agency. I didn't know the Italians had a space agency. Cassini spacecraft was a keystone of exploration of the Saturn system and of gaseous planets in our solar system. Some great pictures it took, too. And as we delve into space exploration, taking the little Skywatcher spaceship out to join OSIRIS-REx, NASA's asteroid sampling mission that went way, way out in the solar system and landed on asteroid Bennu and took a scoop of the soil and rocks, fired its thrusters and left for Earth in May of 2021, and has just fired them again a few days ago for 30 seconds, a course correction to come back to Earth. And a complicated drop-off of the sample in Utah, the West Desert, via parachute. Utah State University's Space Dynamics Lab designed and built the camera electronics for a three-camera suite on board OSIRIS-REx. The spacecraft returns the sample in September of 2023. In the sky tonight, it's all of our heritage. And as we do a little space exploration of our own, finding a dark spot in the trees near a lake or the ocean or the terracotta of the Moab Rim. On Monday, Mars was shining bright on the line between the horn tips of the stars of Taurus. Tonight, look east once Mars is well up around 10 or 11 p.m. and Mars is still near the mysterious flock of geese-looking constellation, or of course, the Bull. And big, bright, orange Aldebaran and a couple of intriguing double stars make a very interesting V-shape. And into the dark, pre-dawn sky, a moonless Friday morning, offering a good chance to catch some meteors. The meteors of the Orionid meteor shower, debris from Halley's or Halley's or Halley's comet. The shower's origin point, or radiant, will be highest in the hour before the first sign of dawn. So this is when the shower will appear most active. You might see 5 to 20 meteors per hour, and a few catch a little flame as they enter the atmosphere. That's fun to see. The best direction to watch is your darkest direction, probably overhead. The radiant is in Orion's Club under the feet of Gemini. That's where the meteors will appear to be directed away from, but you can pretty much look at the sky and you'll see them. The shower will be less active for a morning or two before and after this, but we'll still see them into the weekend. So look up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T on UPR, with translator stationed statewide and streaming live at upr.org.